This is Neil Chandrias, and I'm the executive director of AML and co-chair for this subcommittee on incentives and subsidies. And with me is Isaac. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, folks. Isaac Vandenberg, CEO of Lunch Alaska, and co-chair on the subcommittee as well.
Great. So we wanted this opportunity at this meeting just to check in. We talked at our last subcommittee meeting about convening prior to the next energy security task force, and I know we will be talking tomorrow, and maybe today we can talk a little bit about what that should look like. But I wanted to pick up on the conversation we started at our initial incentives and subsidies subcommittee meeting, and maybe first. Just want to recognize the team at Michael Baker. Michael and Karen are here. Casey, who are you with?
He's also with Michael Baker.
Michael Baker. And Katie Conlon, on from Denali Commission, for the work, I guess. I think the goal is to pick up on where we left off last time and maybe review the action worksheet. Actually, Michael, do you have easy access to that action worksheet, and could you share that?
I do.
I thought you might just happen to have it up.
And then over the weekend, one of the members, Duff, added actions. I brought them to the top, and I deferred to the chairs and co-chairs if they want to discuss them now or just quickly scroll through it.
Can we just scroll through it for a minute. I think one and two came from our conversation last time, right? The funding and implementation toolkit.
Correct. And then I know we had some follow-up actions we were tracking from the last meeting that I sent to you in email. I don't have that handy on my screen, but I can pull it up if you request. And then what Duff added over the weekend was everything, below state of Alaska and then below federal, stopping at this orange bar. This represents kind of the survey of what we've done from, or information we pulled from other state energy master plans that could be relevant, but just more just a survey of emerging trends we're seeing.
Yeah. So, I like and hope that we can talk and add to an agenda these additions from our other team member, Duff Mitchell. These are creative approaches to financing energy projects, review of tax incentives, including property tax exemptions, tax incentives related to income tax exemptions, a liability subsidy, and energy development incentives, including, and this maybe gets commended to the regulatory subcommittee, but providing regulatory streamlining and prioritization. Could you scroll down, Michael? Discussion of state primacy, federal land, RS-2477s. Maybe we should invite the regulatory and statutory subcommittee to come talk to us about those things or see how they fit together. And then a federal Alaska Renewable Energy and Transition Line Fund is maybe something to think about related to the congressional delegation. But Isaac, do you have any thoughts about any of those additions or how we could approach some of those or how to talk about them either tomorrow or in future meetings?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering kind of order of operations here. Are we jumping too far ahead and saying here are things that we're recommending as actions, or do we need to take a step back and just kind of survey the landscape for what already exists and get a state of play for all the incentives and tax breaks and I still feel like there's a little bit of surveying and scanning landscape and getting the baseline in place. And these are all great ideas and creative ideas, and I think things that are out there in the ether that people are talking about. But I just kind of want to clarify our order of operations here and see what, if this is step one or if this is maybe something that we just dog ear and come back to once we have a solid grounding and the state of play.
And Michael, maybe, I mean, that's a good, even in terms of these action worksheets, I know that Michael Baker had added a bunch of kind of an environmental scan of the space and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is the purpose of the action worksheet, and those are like, those are mechanisms for financing, for incentives or subsidies, and they're programmatic, but is that the purpose of the action worksheet, is to like identify a weatherization program, or is it, or is it something, yeah.
So the worksheet's kind of a little bit of both, just because of how fast this is moving. We kind of want to track the ideas that we're considering and then the ones we want to recommend. So if there's ones that we're, and we can update the kind of how we're reporting this, but I do have a tab here for kind of action status. I can, you know, new, ongoing, withdrawn. I could just add one, you know, for further research. You know, category across the board. But, you know, let me just, if it's okay with you, you know, we're the game plan for tomorrow for the task force meeting.
Yeah.
I think most of the committees would have met once. It's still kind of early on in the process, but since this is a quickly moving process, there's going to be breakout sessions where I think the subcommittees, are going to, continue to understand what they may need moving forward, whether that's research. I know in a previous meeting, Karen Bell, she's, doing research on kind of the state funding that's out there in the programs for AEA. And, I think she was going to deliver that this week. So I think that'll help you. Think of this really as the funnel where we're starting to identify which actions we want to research. If there's ones that we know we definitely want to consider for future modeling purposes for the regions, that may link to this subcommittee as well. So there's going to be actions that overlap subcommittees, as you mentioned with the statutes and regulatory subcommittee. So part of tomorrow, I think, it's going to be a little messy process, but I think that's just naturally how it is with committees. But we're going to have breakout sessions and focus on, are there actions that we want to prioritize? What do we need more information on? And are there actions that we need to coordinate with other subcommittees to be successful? So I think we're going to go through that in the morning. At the end, the task force is going to meet and report out. And then we'll track those action items as it progresses with each of the committees.
Great. Okay. So those subcommittee meetings will take place in the morning. Is that part of the plan tomorrow?
There's going to be the agenda. I don't have it pulled up, but there's two presentations that got added in the morning. One on the data energy. So we'll have one on that, and then Black and Beach is going to be presenting on their energy scenario planning, the overall process, what that's going to look like. And then we'll have one breakout session, go to lunch, have another breakout session for subcommittees, and then the complete task force is going to meet at the end of the day. And the way the subcommittees are broken out, I think three of them are meeting at one time. I think it's going to be because of the limited capability of the facility, there are only three rooms available. So there's going to be a chance to kind of attend a subcommittee meeting that you may not be on.
Okay. Isaac, I'm not there in person, and I'll actually be in Homer for our summer conference. We've got a board meeting that starts at 1, so I'm only going to be there in the morning. So I'll be available or something in the morning and contribute there, and then we'll have to think about what if we're on in the afternoon, what that looks like.
Yeah, I had I had planned to not be there in person tomorrow, but my schedule has changed. I can show up to be there in person, so at least one of us is there in person if need be tomorrow. I'll bring my own lunch because I missed the cutoff.
I'm sure there will be plenty.
Yeah, I'll be there in person.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you going to be available by phone, though, in the afternoon, or not at all?
No, I've got my board meeting to run, so, no. And that was kind of one of the reasons to meet ahead of time, too, is make sure that we had something of a plan for tomorrow. Michael, could you go back over and run through the rest of the list of, and you could just kind of scroll slowly for the actions that you've identified so far. And so the rest of this is items from other states, CPACE, weatherization, and so on, from Utah, different bills related to energy consuming, energy efficiency programs, incentives for alternative energy and renewables, production tax credits, energy performance contracting from Georgia, Wyoming's in there. And all that led me to think a little bit about, like, are these the things that we want on our action worksheet?
They may not be in it. That's why they're highlighted.
Yeah. But it's responsive to, like, our request for, you know, what's out there, right? So I think that's good. If I could share my screen.
I did want to just let you know, too, the Statutes and Regulations Subcommittee did meet. So you're through this worksheet, you're able to see their current list of actions.
All right. Okay. Great.
I'll stop presenting.
Okay. And so I had drafted this. You can see that okay?
Yes.
And Isaac, I think this mirrors some of our early conversation, but I think, you know, we started this in the last subcommittee meeting. I don't know that we nailed down or put in writing a goal for us, but I made this up to leverage existing and new financial mechanisms that contribute to lowering the cost of energy in Alaska. I think that summed up for me what we were talking about. And then at the last subcommittee meeting, we spent time on terms, incentive and subsidy. And I think, I mean, it was fairly wide ranging, and I didn't have the transcript or notes to, you know, really reference what we talked about directly, but scoped this out based, you know, on conversations that we've had, you know, that an incentive is there to achieve something specific related to policy and changing behavior or getting to a desired outcome. I didn't define subsidy, but I broke it out by consumer and project. I think the important thing for me is that when it came to incentives, you know, it's clearly an investment that a government could make. It can contribute dollars to a project to achieve that outcome. We didn't get into, you know, what that would look like. And it could be any level of grant funding, but I like this idea of thinking about it in specific terms. And so I put here, you know, that an investment is a grant of not more than 50% of a project. Really, it's closing the gap between, you know, where a project is feasible, but not as cost beneficial as, you know, a developer needs. Like, this gives it that extra kind of over the finish line opportunity. I also included in here low interest loans, but we could identify other types of investments. And then I don't remember if this is the right way to think about rebate, but the other type of incentive in my mind is when government foregoes revenue. So one is here's cash, and then the other is for government is deferring an opportunity for cash. And that could be through deferred or abated taxes or tax credits. And those were some of the things that Duff mentioned too as wanting to talk more about. So I think that's how I was thinking about incentive. I think subsidy is defined both by a consumer level and a project level, but a subsidy providing financial resources to offset costs experienced by the consumer, and the same thing for a project where a business case is not feasible, the government is providing additional funding. And that, for me, is when a grant is not less than 50%, and it's probably more like 80% of a project. It's the way to think about a subsidy. But I think, you know, it's important to think about both levels of government investment and not just a single, you know, one size fits all for government investment and funding, that there are different ways to structure government funding to achieve different purposes. And where one is an incentive, a subsidy, I think, you know, a large portion of what Alaska or even federal government contributes to a lot of projects is a subsidy. And I think framing that is important. For the consumer, you know, it's a payment to the consumer or to the utility, to bring down high costs. Isaac, does that track for you? And are we thinking about these things? Is there anything more you would add?
Yeah, I think that all seems right. The only thing that is new to me is the not more than 50% of the project, or that threshold that you're setting there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I think it can run the gamut, but I think it's interesting just as a structure that you're proposing to look at qualifying these as not less than 50% or not more than 50% of the project. But I also think that one other differentiator is with investments, that there's typically some kind of a return expectation or someone is getting paid back.
Yeah.
With the subsidy, it's just, it's truly a grant. There's no interest on that. Or there's no expectation of repayment to anyone. It's just, money that we're using to artificially bring down a price for some off-taker or some customer or something.
Right.
But yeah.
I wondered about an investment having a return, because that's how I would think about it too. But I didn't have good examples of what that looked like, except for, you know, the government taking an ownership stake, essentially, right?
Yeah, or government-backed loan guarantees, or even projects where there's multiple investors and the government, provides a portion of the capital stack, but then other investors in that project actually get a return out of it. I think those are all examples. Did you have something there, Michael?
Yeah, an interesting conversation came up. I think I mentioned this on the first statutes and regs meeting. They had a member of the ATA present, and one of the kind of state policy issues they were looking at was the local match for federal grants, if there's a way for, you know, the state to help pay that. But what that also kind of started talking about was that return on investment and how long, you know, the long tail benefits of kind of large infrastructure projects, because a large infrastructure project may increase rates in the short term, but in the long term it might be cost effective. So I'm just curious too how that relates to the goal of this and your increase. And that was a kind of a question they had at the committee as well. Like, if we're increasing rates in the short term, but long term there's benefits, is that acceptable?
Interesting. Yeah. We talked in the last meeting about, you know, these different time horizons too, right? And I wonder if, I mean, you mitigate that, right? If there's higher rates initially, is there a role for government to bring those down? And then to the extent that there's a payback, you know, at the other end, maybe you flatten out that curve, and that's a role for government. all kinds of fun things you could do with financing.
But I do know, like, just in applying for federal grants, when you have to show the cost effectiveness, generally a benefit cost analysis will look at the design life of the infrastructure and take that into account.
Let me talk. So those would be good things for us to dive into. The short and long term horizons of projects. I wanted maybe on this call to spend time too on programs, and we could bring it up tomorrow, Isaac. A lot of the things on the action worksheet are programs that increase efficiency. I mean, I would say maybe 50% of the activities on there. And I'm not, and so I struggle with, Michael, you saw my economist thing via email, but my question, I think, to the group is, do those programs contribute to lower cost energy? And my not very good economist thing was no, that the, you know, energy efficiency, weatherization, energy conservation programs generally, like, are good, right? They reduce probably for the consumer or and the ratepayer their total bill. But does that lowering of energy use result in lower costs at the utility level, which should translate into lower rates? And I don't, it could be that the answer is no, that if, unless that's maximized somehow, right? And if a utility is built around a certain model for its costs, it could be that the lower amount of energy used actually increases, you know, the cost per kilowatt hour, and there's probably some equilibrium that you have to get to, economy of scale, that enough use translates into lower cost per kilowatt hour. Michael, how does that work? I mean, do we need an economist to come to the group and say, like, here's how to lower cost at utility level?
What I was thinking too, that Black & Veatch, they're contracted through the governor's office, and Michael Baker's contracted through AEA, but they're kind of tasked with looking at kind of the regional energy models for the regions, not necessarily for, you know, some of these other subcommittees with, you know, statutes and regs, but that might be a good conversation to have with them, because it's all about how you model, like, demand versus supply almost, right?
Yeah.
So.
And part of me is, I mean, the number of those programs that are out there, I mean, like, that might feel like low-hanging fruit for governments. And if it lowers a consumer's total bill, then, you know, that might be why they're doing that. But it might not achieve some of the longer-term goals of lowering energy costs or having projects that you know, result in more affordable energy on the other side. And I wonder if we need to think about, you know, maybe not, I don't want to suggest moving away from those programs, because they probably do have many benefits. But, I mean, should we think about alternative investment strategies, from governments? If we're putting $50 million into weatherization, is that three projects that would in communities to bring, you know, cost down to 10 kilowatt hour or 10 cent kilowatt hour power? I don't know. Isaac, do you have any thoughts about having that conversation?
Yeah, and I think the problem you're trying to solve for is what's the best use of a dollar that we have to spend on something, and which use of that dollar is going to be the most effective in bringing down the kind of cost of energy for Alaskans.
Right.
And it's not a simple thing, although I would say that, like, in the rail belt context, I think, you know, energy efficiency is a good idea for bringing down electricity prices for folks because of the issue of demand charges, where, you know, if you have customers who are using huge amounts of energy, that causes the utility to fire on more and more expensive generation assets. So they'll, you know, hopefully dispatch their cheapest assets first, and then as there's more demand, then they have to fire on older, more expensive assets. And as there's more demand, you know, they fire on the things that haven't been fired for 5 years and are super inefficient, but at least give enough power to the grid. And so I think that that is a consideration. Like, it's good to be energy efficient because it allows utilities to use their cheapest, most efficient, most high performing assets, theoretically. So I think that's a thing.
Okay.
And having said that, I think there's another, you know, consideration here, which is generally larger. If you're looking at solar or wind, the bigger you get, generally, the cheaper it gets. So, you know, that's why some of the largest solar farms, you know, you just reach economies of scale. Like, for instance, the project that Jen and Rick have done out in Willow and then in Houston, the bigger they get, the cheaper, you know, their power will get, because you just reach economies of scale and you're spreading out those kind of integration costs and grid studies and all that stuff. You're spreading out across a larger project size. So generally, it's better to deploy larger projects because it brings down the cost of energy. So yeah, I think it's dynamic. I don't think it's a simple question. I'd also be curious. I know Katie's on the call here. If she wants to chime in, she's a super brainiac as well. Get her thought on this. But yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that I think we're holding up to the rest of the group is like, let's look at all of the potential energy sources that we have and all of the rebates and incentives, or all the incentives and subsidies that we have access to or may have access to soon. And let's come, you know, try to get as much of an apples to apples comparison and come out, you know, come up with a bit of a roadmap for, you know, how can we use the best combination of incentives and subsidies and where we think these different energy technologies are headed to have the most, you know, the most impact on bringing down. Like, I know I'm oversimplifying it, but I think that's what we're doing here is trying to pull back, get clarity on how we're subsidizing or incentivizing our current energy practices and how we might use a different combination of incentives and subsidies and give it and look at other technologies to make a real impact.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do, right?
Yeah. I think, Michael, that's part of, I mean, the work that Karen is doing to identify here's current things that the state of Alaska is paying for, either through, either programmatically, with grants and subsidies, or as incentives. Like that's, and then if, you know, and then we can add on top of that, here's what the federal government is, and then we need to dashboard that out for, you know, what is this contributing to lowering the cost of energy or other types of, or meeting other types of goals.
Not to interrupt you, but someone did join by phone. Is that Katie? Were you having trouble with your audio before?
No, I'm, that's not me. I'm here though.
Okay. Whoever identified or joined by phone, can you please identify yourself just for the record?
Yeah, it's Curtis. I was just drawing one.
Oh, hey Curtis.
Curtis.
Yeah. So I think that.
Okay.
I mean, and that even gets to, I mean, you know, Duff adding, like, here's new things we need is great, or anybody who's got a new idea is great, but we want to make sure all the existing forms of incentives and subsidies that are out there, are we utilizing them to the best effect as it relates to lowering the cost of energy for Alaskans? And then what are the gaps that we need to fill? What do we need to create new from that?
And
go ahead, Michael.
I was going to just say, Curtis, since you just joined, Duff did populate the action worksheets. He unfortunately couldn't join today, but he has like 10 actions for consideration, state and federal. And then, Isaac, I'll definitely defer to you, but there, I just want to mention, we can talk about this a little later, too, some of the actions from the statutes and regs subcommittee and how the intersection with the subcommittee.
Okay, great. Yeah, it also seems, just to further your point, Niels, there, you know, not only having a clear view on what we're currently sort of subsidizing and incentivizing what we might do in the future, but also, like, I think there is a scenario where we suggest not subsidizing things anymore. Like, this isn't all just adding new stuff. It's also, like, is there stuff that needs to go away that is no longer our best bang for our buck? And I know this all of a sudden gets super touchy, because that's one of the hardest things to do, is to take away subsidies or incentives. But if we're trying to be
as long as we can show what that transition could look like in a way that doesn't negatively impact people along the way, right? That's how you move from subsidy to sustainability.
Sorry. Just out of curiosity, when the regions start doing their kind of energy models, you know, and we have to talk to Black and Beach about this, would there be assumptions that you may want to test out on the incentives or subsidy side?
I think the answer is yes. And if you're going to ask which ones, I don't
know. We're not there yet, I know.
But yeah, I think so. That would be really powerful to be able to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Tomorrow they're going to go over their kind of overall process and timeline. So I want to make sure we kind of build those in.
Yeah. Okay. This is helpful. So I think we've been working through a couple of different ways to approach this, and one of the things that Andrew said last time I want to really highlight or dig into a little bit, related to PCE, while we're talking about subsidies, is related to PCE, and he's made, you know, a couple comments about, you know, PCE not working, and I think what I understood from him last time is it's not that PCE isn't working for those who receive it. It's not working for those who don't receive it, right? For businesses and others who aren't benefiting from a subsidy. And then it's not working as well as it could relative to rates that are being paid elsewhere in the state. So I think those were the two ways that he was thinking about it is, and I just wanted to make sure we capture that effectively, because, you know, on the one, if businesses had access to, you know, some kind of rate subsidy, then I think his argument was it would lower costs, you know, the cost of goods and services, et cetera, across the state. There would be a reduced transaction cost, that could be assumed or modeled. So, there was that. And then, you know, he was really looking, you know, less at an equity equation and more on a whatever is being paid on the rail belt is the same as what should be paid elsewhere. And it's not and more kind of a one-to-one and not an adjustment at the consumer level, the other argument that he was making. And both of those have, you know, very huge implications for the PCE endowment and what would be needed to actually accomplish one or both. But I think the goals of both those things are really important, and we want to keep them in mind. Like, it might not be PCE that's the answer for both those things, but are there ways to address those questions or those challenges, in new or different ways? So I wanted to, have that on the record too, that, that might be how we think about it, and not just, I think a couple times the comment has been PCE's not working. I think that's not, it's not working, you know, relative to a couple different other factors.
Yeah.
So making that connection to the statutes and rights subcommittee, the PCE came up And Curtis, I think it was the King Cove kind of issue an example. And then, two other topics, I think the Emerging Technology Fund, revisiting that, what that would look like. And then the third one, I'm blanking on, but I can look at my screen, but Curtis, if you're on. If not, I'll just pull up my screen.
The third one, wasn't that the RCA, or was that something else?
That is, and that's actually on my screen. It was the restructuring of RCA. Yeah, I'll just share my screen.
Glad we don't have that one, Isaac. But I do, I think the King Cove example, Isaac, if you're not familiar with it, is basically, a community made an investment into a hydro, and it brought down their kilowatt hour cost below what is PCE reimbursable or whatever. And so now they're no longer eligible for PCE as a community, but the city government is on the hook for the bond debt repayment. So they're looking at, is there a new way to think about, communities being able to make investments like that and having some sort of funding available to assist with the bond, the debt, either reimbursement or offset? I think that's kind of the question there.
Go ahead, please.
No, I was just saying the issue on King Cove, and it affects most of the communities that go renewable, is DCE was established 4 years ago. It was to lower the cost, and what it was to do is to bring it on par with the rail belt. So any cost between the rail belt cost, which is 20 cents, is evaluated every year, up to a dollar, that 80 cent spread, depending on where the community falls, it pays that difference. But what you have is like King Cove. You had King Cove, which dropped below the 20 cents, so they're not eligible for PC by statute. And so the issue is do you change the statute that governs that with the PC endowment? Another piece of that is it is an endowment. The endowment has a, and so if you take more out of the endowment, how does that change future funding? So that's where the crutch is just really the PC endowment and a statutory change to it. The one thing I will say for PCE, they feel they have missed out on $2 million worth of PCE, about $200,000 or $100,000 a year for the past 20 years. However, they've also received $3.8 million in grants to get them to go renewable. So there is a trade-off there we have to look at with any community, I think. But anyhow, that was the PCE background. It has to be a statutory change.
Right. Yep. But too, I think a statutory change is like we need to know what we're aiming at if there were to be a statutory change. And I think some of the subsidy or incentive conversation, how to structure state investment is critical. Isaac?
Yeah, and also just again stepping back, the state has money to spend on something. Is the way the PCE program run the most effective way for the energy to accomplish its goal of bringing down the cost of, electricity or energy for rural residents? Could hold that program up to what if the state just bought batteries, for communities, and those batteries enabled, IPPs with private investors to come in and build wind and solar because the batteries are an enabler, as just one example. Or, what if that money that the state is spending went straight into some other technology or was deployed differently? That's what we're talking about, I think, in this subcommittee. For every dollar the state is spending, what's the most effective way to, impact the change that we're trying to impact here?
Does it achieve lower cost energy? I wanted to add operating costs to our list and see if we can get more information on that. We work with communities on water and sewer issues, and it's come up a few times that one of the major costs of running a utility is the operator cost. and, you know, the state would prefer a second trained operator in every community, which maybe ADA's circuit rider program does to some extent, but DEC calculated that, you know, to add a second operator to, you know, communities that need it would be $10 million, which to me doesn't sound unreasonable. If you think about it in terms of having that, paying for that operator would bring a community's ratepayer cost of $300 down to a month, down to $150. Like it would have its rates per ratepayer. Like is there something to that we could consider in terms of bringing down the cost of power? Is it, or are we just talking about the straight cost of power, or is it the delivered cost and our operations and maintenance, you know, one way to achieve lower costs?
Just a quick point of information. I think you may be aware of this, but like federal grants, that's one thing that they don't typically fund is maintenance costs, unless it's a, mm-hmm. you can make the case that it's a critical repair.
And that's the problem with water and sewer too. Same thing, right? It's mostly federal money. So it would require not federal money to make that change. But it would have, you know, it'd be a different type of subsidy, that would lower costs.
Yeah. And I think it's a great point. I would also just point out that, like, when you have a privately funded, you know, solar farm, say, or an energy project, the investors in that project require some kind of very clear O&M plan over the 20-year or 30-year life of that project, and that is baked into the cost of that project. So whoever builds it or whoever delivers it has to make a very convincing argument that the project cash flows are going to pay for the maintenance, operations maintenance, to make sure that those investors get their cash over the life of the project.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when we're thinking about, like, what do we incentivize? What kind of projects do we incentivize? Do we want to be spending government money on O&M, or do we want to be using government money to catalyze projects where the O&M is baked into the cost of that project that private investors, you know, are paying for?
Couldn't it have the same effect? Right. I mean, if a government backed maintenance and operations was baked in, then it would lower the cost to those investors, and right, and that would be part of that plan. And it would it would limit their exposure and increase, you know, their potential return to some extent if the government was offsetting. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess
maybe
if the government kind of makes the bed for projects to be developed with private investors, then I think you know, you avoid the problem where we're 10 years into a project and the project is not performing. We have to go back to government coffers, and who knows what the politics of the day or the budget of the day or the administration of the day will feel about that. Whereas, you know, if we have this window over the next 4 or 5 years
mm-hmm.
where we want to be catalyzing a bunch of projects that get turned over and are, you know, the responsibility for operating and maintaining those projects is shifted to the private sector, like, that seems like the right way to do it, to me.
As we're thinking about the, you know, mobilizing private capital, which, you know, isn't on our action worksheet really yet, or maybe it is a little bit, you know, is that, Isaac, is your sense that, you know, that's mostly occurring where there's an economy of scale, where there's a business case, where there's enough people? I mean, is it the rail belt and maybe some larger communities where private capital is more easily mobilized? Or maybe my question, is there a role for private capital in the delivery of energy projects in small communities or rural Alaska? And if so, like, you know, how do we how do we structure that or evaluate it or incentivize it? Or if not, I don't know. Any thoughts there?
I think that's the right question to ask. I'm not meaning to avoid your question, but I think the thing this group is trying to do is to figure out if we can patch together any incentives and subsidies to make some of the projects, especially in non-railbelt communities in the state, pencil out for potential private investors. And so I think, yeah, that's one fundamental question we should be asking. I mean, I think there are infrastructure funds and there are groups that are developing, you know, interesting approaches to hydrogen and hydrogen airplanes who are looking at making investments in communities and airports throughout the state. And there are things out there that are interesting, but we don't know yet. It still is hard to find projects that are economic and pencil out.
To your point about not trusting the government in future years, I think that's what you said. is there some need for private capital? I mean, if they're going to de-risk a project or have some level of certainty about what happens in years 5 through 30, do you need more of, you know, government activity at the front end versus a commitment to long term? Is that what private capital is looking for? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. And also just things like signaling that this is the direction the state is headed in. Like, it's not our subcommittee's work, but I think mandates or, you know.
Something in law. Yeah.
Right. It says, like, this is where we're headed. This is, you know, this is the mix that we're headed. That we're trying to get as a state, all that is incredibly helpful to the private sector to,
Michael, sorry.
Crazy investing.
No, it's okay. This is a great conversation on public-private, you know, partnerships, but I didn't want to interrupt it. But I did want to point out on the rural subcommittee, I think I pulled up from my screen, they did talk about this kind of indirectly, you know, identifying the, you know, energy anchor tenants to provide economies of scale. And typically those would be, you know, the fishing, mining, industrial tenants. So.
Yeah. So I'll get back to economy of scale. I mean, if you need to make a business case for it, right, then you need economy of scale or anchor institution. Unless you have a government to back up or otherwise subsidy the project. Okay. Isaac, wide ranging a little bit, and a good conversation. What can we focus on tomorrow that either moves this forward or draws in additional thoughts from the subcommittee? Yes. Or Michael, do you have an agenda for us?
We will be circulating one, but you know, I think when we started the meeting, kind of thinking about which actions do you think are worth kind of, even though we're kind of in the beginning stages, we are moving fast. Which actions do you think have legs for the next stage of this? Which ones do you need more information by coordinating with other subcommittees on? And then what information do we need to do more research or we're waiting for so we can help expedite that? I think that's how I would kind of think about this. And there's different categories you're looking at, like the subsidies, incentives, tax. So maybe you start thinking about it in terms of those categories, just to break it down.
Yeah, I do feel that it would be helpful to get, like I keep saying, it's got to get clarity on our baseline or understand the way that our current approach is subsidized or incentivized. And there's a long list of things in our tax code that are, you know, subsidizing or incentivizing our current system. There are things like CCE. Just being crystal clear that the current the current system is highly subsidized and incentivized as well. And we should know what those numbers are. Is it $10? Is it $100?
Yeah.
Like have that number in mind, and what are the subsidies and incentives that are currently holding up the current system that we have, as a way to then think about, okay, like the new system is also going to need some incentives and subsidies. Which ones are we removing? What are we adding? What are we changing? And that's something that I'm just needing to get clarity on to really even be able to wrap my head around the complexity of this group. And so I would love to have that be one lane of effort here. Let's just be clear on what currently exists and what we're currently paying for.
I mean, can I
I just wanted to point out too that we have the PCE data broken down by community. So that is information we currently have. Beyond that, there's nothing, I don't think anything on the resources folder relays that.
Right. I think what you're finding, Michael, and at least with this subcommittee or for Isaac and I, is like we really want to understand the landscape before we suggest actions. And mm-hmm. and the structure of the effort is like populate this action worksheet.
Yeah.
And the action for us is let's figure out what we're working with before we suggest actions. Otherwise, and people are just going to kind of spitball, throw stuff out there, and we have no way to evaluate it effectively. I know resources have been provided, but not really where we want it to be yet.
No, I understand that, and I fully appreciate that. I think your subcommittee and the statutes and rights subcommittee, that you're unique in that you kind of have to coordinate with the regional subcommittees and then everyone else to understand the data. It's real easy to get overwhelmed with thinking, well, I need all the data, though. So I guess the recommendation we were kind of talking about with the statutes and rights committee is like, well, what's our real focus areas? What will move the needle to this goal? And, you may not need all the data to make that, case at the moment. But, yeah, but when we move further, you're going to need to do some due diligence.
Right.
I mean, I don't think it's realistic to think that we're going to wrap our heads around all of the data between now and the deadline for this group, but even just something like, PCE costs us, $10,000 in the state every year. The current tax exemptions that we have on the books, the U.S. government forgoes this amount of money every year, just like line item of incentives and rebates. And how much money, where you're foregoing or investing in something to subsidize it is about the level of detail that my simple brain can handle. Without diving into on a community by community basis, how PCE, is being paid for. Very super high level.
Yeah. Could we go through, I could do this probably, or Curtis, you might have it, but could we go through the operating and capital budget and pull out anything that's energy related, and just, list that out? And I'm sure, it's not just an AEA line item, but, all the different line items that are out there. Like, I think that would be interesting, like to Isaac's point, what is the state currently spending on energy right now? That would be a great first step. And not just ADA, but AHFC and, there's probably other agencies who have activities, related to it. And there's municipal exemptions and incentives and rebates too, and that would be a bigger list, but, I think for most local, property or sales taxes, like, do they apply to electric utilities? And if not, what is the value of that? So then what's the value of that? We could try to do that work.
Yeah, and I could certainly help with that as well. I think, there's been some good work done nationally about, how the current system is subsidized or incentivized that I think we could pull from that just has relevance to Alaska,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
We could look at some of that work.
Curtis, are we off base here? Or I know we got to wrap up in a minute, but.
I don't think you are right, because I think when you look at Alaska housing and stuff, I don't think anybody's probably asked for it in a format where we've all pulled it together. That's not kind of asinine, but, I certainly know what AEA has, but, Alaska housing on top of it, there's some stuff over probably with DNR. DEC might have something. So I think that we just need to kind of pull down our want list, and then I think we can just send out the request for information. And I'll reach out to all the commissioners and the Brian Butcher and stuff once we kind of get our list compiled just to move it along. But I don't think it's an outrageous request.
Okay. And if that's something that gets reported out tomorrow, I think that's a success because we're showing progress.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great.
All right. Well, thanks for this. I know so much work, last minute, meeting and a bit of robust discussion. And I think this is valuable. I'm happy to have more of these, whoever can make it and just keep us moving. The blank space in between meetings, I start to get nervous and we should be doing more. So, looking forward to being on as much as I can be tomorrow and before my board meeting. And then Isaac, Grant, I know that he'll be there. In person, if there's anything I can do in between now and then, let me know.
And Michael, just for scheduling purposes, I do have a bit of a conflict tomorrow afternoon between 2:30 and 3:30. That's very hard for me to move. So if there's any way to have my subcommittee or our subcommittee during the not 2:30 to 3:30 slot, that would be great. So just putting that request out.
I'll have to talk to Curtis and the task force, shares, but what time would work for you if we had to move it?
Either 3:30, really any other time during the day other than that 2:30 to 3:30 slot.
Or we could both be on in the morning if the presentations are done, and if it was like 10:30 to noon or something. It sounds like from 1 to 2:30 would work. For you, Isaac, those are a couple options.
Okay, I'll have to, Curtis, it sounds like you're about to say something.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I don't see that being a problem at all. We'll make it work.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody, for this. Yeah. Michael, anything else?
No, I was going to say, you're available today if we need to get in contact and coordinate that, though, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Sounds good. That's all I have.
Cool.
Thanks.
Okay.